This is the Planning Commission work session for Thursday, April 6, 2017. Okay.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Kevin Tyler. I'm with Clark County Public Works, Parks and Lands Division. And I have with me here Hunter Decker, County Forester. Parks and Lands Division is the location where you find a forestry program these days in Clark County. So I'm only here tonight under some extraordinary circumstances. I don't know if any of you have heard yet, but Jim Vandling, the county forester, passed away last night unexpectedly. And so Hunter and I are here to cover the meeting and keep the ball rolling for the open space current use program. And so I understand there are a couple of new members on the Planning Commission. And so we if you're interested, we can kind of quickly go through a presentation that Jim had put together for the open space current use program. You guys let me know what you want to do.
I wouldn't mind seeing it. Okay. That's all right with you guys.
Sure.
Yeah, we can try to
speed a little bit.
Try to get through it. Every year, people have the opportunity to apply for the current use assessment program, which is it's a tax break essentially. And there's a couple of different categories that you can apply for, including timberlands, open space, soil conservation, historic properties, things of that nature. And essentially the code for this comes out of state law. This is not my area of expertise, it was Jim's and it's gonna be Hunter's, but it comes out of RCW 8434 and in the county code. And it allows people, if they meet the criteria in this program, to apply for a tax. It's like a tax deferral. So the process goes like they apply for the program annually. The year before it would go into effect. So the application that we'll have before you tonight is from 2016, and then if it goes through the entire process, you guys will look at it. We've basically recommended that it be approved. You guys will evaluate it and then make a recommendation at your hearing in 2 weeks to the county council. And then the county council is the one who would formally approve the staff report and the application. And then we would mail out an agreement to the landowner. They sign the agreement and we record it on their property. And then they're allowed that lower tax. If they pull the property out of the program later in the future at some point, then they would have to come up with those back taxes, like if they were to develop the property in the future.
I think it's 7 years.
Yeah. They would have to come up with the seven years of back taxes. And there's a formula for how you calculate that, and don't ask me, ask the assessor.
How long is the application good for? I mean, as far as what's approved?
I believe there's a period of time where they...
Like if you sell it...
Once you're into this program...
You're in.
What can kick you out are nuisances on the property, noxious weeds. There are certain things you're required to do to comply with state law, and absent a violation, you stay in. Now, under the Farm and Ag, depending on when you come in, under the Farm and Ag provision, you're required to generate a certain amount of income. So there are eligibility criteria that you have to meet, but for the most part, assuming you do your share as the property owner, whatever you in meeting those, maintaining those eligibility criteria, you're in. And so where the payoff is, it starts out at, we'll say, year 10, because there is interest, depending on when you give notice, if you give 2 years notice and some other things, you pay back taxes, but once you get to year 10, there's a net gain. So for people who intend to really leave these in here for long periods, 15, 20 years, it can be a substantial benefit. And of course, the community benefit is either that this property stays in resource, barn and ag, timber, one of the protected uses, or open space. And that's the exchange, that there's a public benefit, there's a private gain, and it works out for both parties. But to answer your question, you're in until you no longer qualify, or you take it out by sale, or if you plat the property, when you actually create the lots, when the plat is recorded, it's not just the subdivision approval, but when the plat is recorded and it no longer meets minimum lot sizes, then you'd be removed from the program and required to pay your back taxes.
Another example would be if you're in timberland, you have to have a timber management plan, and if you were to harvest the timber and not replant and not follow your timber management plan, that's reason to be kicked out of the program. But
I want to back up on one more thing, the tax taxation.
Yeah, you back up to the tax shift.
Tax shift.
Oh, that. Yeah. Can I elaborate more on that about the other taxpayers in the county having to make up the difference?
Yeah, so when somebody comes into the program and they qualify for the program and the application is approved and they have that tax, that lower tax applied to their property, it's not like the county collects less tax. It's that tax is then shifted to the other property owners in that tax district. So it's the benefit of, one property owner, these things that we find value, timberland, open space, conservation areas, soil, agriculture. The community at large benefits, but the community at large also bears that tax burden. So it's something that we want to take seriously when we approve these. And then we can kind of talk about if they're removed. There's different categories. One of them is open space. Minimum parcel size is 10 acres. These would be things like conservation, enhancement of natural resources. Some of the other ones are if it's along the shoreline of the state, so protection of the resources along streams that are of statewide significance. Recreational opportunities like this is the Washougal motocross, right? So that has a community-wide benefit of recreational opportunity, and so they might qualify. Historic resources, so if it's listed on the National Register, it could qualify. Some of the buildings downtown here, actually, like Kiggins Theater, I believe it's on the National Register, but it's also qualifies for the program and has applied for and has that tax status. Soil conservation, the one that we're looking at today has applied for soil conservation under the open space program. And then timberland is the other big one that we've seen traditionally. Quite a few applications coming in for this. We're not seeing timberland applications really anymore because at the state level, there was a new bill passed that said we're not going to have counties shouldn't have both a designated forest lands program and an open space timberland program. They changed the qualifications for the designated forest land program, lowering the minimum to 5 acres. And so counties are supposed to go through a process of picking one or the other. We haven't done that yet, but I would assume that's coming in the future. And so now people can come in and they can say, I can apply for open space, the timberlands program, and pay a $2,000 application fee, or I can apply for designated forest lands and pay a $150 fee. And so which one do you think they're going to choose, right? So we're seeing a lot of people come in through the designated forest lands program and not this one. Like I said, 5-acre minimum for the timberland. program that's in it, that's not including a 1 acre home site. So if you want to be in the program, you'd have to have 6 acres and if you had a home on the property. And then these are some criteria for if you are in the timberland program. That's probably good on the trend. This was some trends from years ago that don't apply anymore because, like I mentioned, timberland isn't happening anymore. So one of the things that we've seen that Jim saw since he's been here, he started in 1998, and so in that time with these programs and really getting them out there to the people, we've seen Clark County jump from 19th to 11th on the list of counties, like timber counties, timber producing counties. So you know, it's a pretty interesting trend. And then these are some of the sources of assistance aside from our own county forester out there in the community, that where people can go and get help determining how to manage their land for forest use. So that's in a nutshell my fake it till you make it effort to try to explain the current use timber program to you. Or current use open space. Interesting note, last year when Jim gave this presentation and talked to you guys, I think, and we looked at the notes today, one of the office assistants that helped us, she noted that Jim said you would not see his face here next year in those notes. Some irony there for you guys. And so we have the new face of Clark County Forestry for you here. Hunter Decker, he will be taking this show from now on. And so what we have before you today is one application for current use, and it is the, as I mentioned, soil conservation for the Nye family. And on a property, I think that's a typo, it's not 147.99 acres. No, I guess it is. So they're asking for approval of the open space application for their property out in near Clark County Fairgrounds and Whipple Creek Regional Park.
So,
do you guys have any questions?
Yeah. So when you consider the application and it goes through the criteria that are listed, what consideration is given to how this property might fit into some overall master plan of where you want to see open space in the future and the types of open space and the opportunities that that's going to be given? Or is that one of them?
I mean, that's definitely something that we could talk about and plan on in the future. I mean, I don't think it's something that maybe we've overarchingly looked at like a landscape level point of view. Is that?
Yeah, because you know, if you're looking at sort of the greening of the county, there's logical areas, and have you got a program mm-hmm. where you want to sort of encourage this program to come through as a cost-effective way of deriving additional open space, retaining open space, but it's forming a continuous network which gives rise to other opportunities. That's the sort of thing I'm wondering. How does it all come together? And then if you are getting multiple applications, does anyone look at it and say, wow, this tax district's been hit really heavily, but we've got nothing over here? Where does that all float around?
Those are all excellent questions that I don't have the answer for, but we can, you know, we can bring those back to you at the hearing if you'd like. You know, I think that, so one, the county does have a conservation futures program, conservation futures, and they have an acquisition plan that goes along with that, and it identifies areas in the county that we would like to acquire because of their conservation value. I don't know the answer to the question about how these are looked at in terms of what properties and what districts are, and how many, and what that does to the tax base, and how that influences other property owners. But it's, it's probably something that we should look at in more detail.
Yeah.
If we're not, and that we would need to talk to the assessor about that as well.
And then it flows on to another thing. People get very passionate, they're committed, they want to give open space. And then what again has the county got in terms of evaluating and saying, in terms of the various habitats within the community, we are lowly or poorly represented in this type, yet we keep accepting everything over here in this category, and we're not balancing it up and truing it up and reconciling the long-term impacts of the community. That's the other.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
Maybe like with community development kind of part of that too?
I would think so, just with the different habitats that are available or that are out there that have been defined by the State Department of Fish and Wildlife. You know, what are the priorities on a statewide level?
And what are they to account for?
Yeah.
And then just one more question and then colleagues will probably kick in. This one ticks the box about unique wildlife or threatened wildlife. Is there any unique or threatened wildlife on the property?
Well, part, I think, of the application is going through like a checklist of seeing if there's certain layers that the government has, like the state has fish and wildlife, threatened wildlife species layer, and if there's something like on the bubble on that radar, then it puts a red flag up for that property owner to have some state official to come out and inspect the property. And if they don't find anything, then they make a note of that.
So when this application is assessed by staff and there's two boxes ticked, protecting streams, corridors, waterfalls, whatever, and then protecting conservation, or protecting soil resources, unique or critical wildlife. Was that accepted at face value, or was there an on-site assessment? No.
Again, the individual who did this work is no longer with us. And based on the staff report that was provided to you, you know, he said that an on-site review was done and indicated that the area contains greater than or equal to 10 acres of what we call class 2 soil types, which are the Hillsborough silt loam, and that the area applied for is in greater than 80% food and fiber production. So those are two of the criteria that have to be met in order for it to meet that soil conservation, which again is more of the agricultural and less of the fish and wildlife and habitat perspective.
Do you have a list of criteria, or is it in the book?
No, not in front of me.
Could I have
one? As I say, the only thing they have is the checklist. As far as how you evaluate the checklist,
that's going to be there.
I would imagine it'd be like RCW.
RCW and county code.
Sure, would spell it verbatim in there.
My experience with Jim and the history of going through this is he walked every single application before the checklist got filled out. And I don't believe there's a denial process based on whether there's a targeted zone for a particular type of inclusion or exclusion. I believe this was really application driven and whether they met the criteria or not without regard to where it was. I think based on the data, the limited data that was up here though, we can see in the timber process how effective it was to actually retain timber and how it drove the kind of behavior overall for the county that the law was trying to derive out of it by moving us up into the middle of the pack from timber-bearing renewable resource. So I think each one of these particular types of applications is driven by a different desire for outcome. But I don't know that we get to pick and choose. I think if they meet the criteria, my experience on this in the past has been it's a yes-no kind of situation. And we can't say it's not in the zone that we really wanted to produce more timber in, so sorry, we're not going to let you in. I think it doesn't work that way.
I think Ron's right. I would also add that the map, which I believe comes straight from GIS, does mm-hmm. show a creek crossing a corner of the property.
Yeah.
And it shows another creek very close in proximity on the south side of the property.
And just knowing Jim and his history here at the county, working in the last 19 years, and he's a rural property owner, and he was always very conscientious about the fees that people had to pay. He was always, I mean, he fought me on how much we needed to charge for forest practice permits because he knew that people didn't want to pay it, even though we had to cover his time in reviewing those applications. So he would, like you mentioned, he would go out and work with property owners before they ever applied because he didn't want, at $2,000, he didn't want somebody applying for a permit and then deciding that we couldn't approve the application. That's bad business. But these are good questions, and I apologize for not having those answers for you tonight, but we can definitely listen to the notes, listen to the recording, and get those answers for you at the hearing.
Might want to include the riparian wetland and soils maps in the final packet, so we have more than just this one map, because I think that'd be easy to pull that from GIS.
Yeah, it is, definitely.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day where I'm coming from is you should be able to make a decision based upon the information here, mm-hmm. and if it does tick a box that says, you know, unique or critical wildlife, then we should be able to say it's because of A, B, and C, and hey, this is a really good application. It is a very good program. But how this fits into our overall big scheme of where we want to go, this is where we're headed, and yes, it does, or something, we'll just be able to quantify some of the parameters. Because local government, county government, state government get lots of offerings of land, and they can get saddled with a lot of problems in the long term with it. And it's how do you balance the road between the true supporters and the non-supporters. That's all. Okay.
You guys have any more questions? Or
is the tax really a Washington code or
a
local code?
It's Washington code, yeah.
Have a question?
Yeah.
And probably don't know the answer to it, but how many acres do we have in Clark County that's
in current use?
I'm just curious.
Anybody do that? We can get that. That's a really good question, because one of the factors the council is required to consider is just the very question that I think at least one of you has asked, which is, what is the impact of, what's the benefit of this versus the impact on the system? And they have discretion. It's not mandatory these be taken in. It's discretionary with the council. And they're supposed to balance and look at just the effect of the tax reduction for the one parcel versus the tax increment increase on the other parcels, and knowing the total number and the ultimate or the cumulative tax impact is a significant issue. And so we can get you that. I mean, that's certainly available to us.
We have a study that was done maybe a year or so, very, very recent. It shows that Clark County is the number one county among the 36 counties of this county's planning on the GMA that has property in current use, and the taxation value is about $1 million.
It's $1 billion.
Yeah. $1 billion, right? We have a study that was conducted on this issue, and we can provide you that.
Is that the value after it's been reduced, or is that the value prior to reduction? You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, but it is the total taxation value of the properties that are incorrect.
The shift value, right?
The shift value. Okay, there we go.
Yeah.
So that billion is spread out amongst everyone else.
Yes.
Yeah. And that includes the landowner on his remaining home.
Right. Yeah. 1 acre is taxed at fair market value.
Right.
Yes. Thank you.
Well, if you guys don't have anything else, we'll try to answer some of these questions in 2 weeks at the hearing and clean up this staff report, add some more information, and try to get a recommendation to the council. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
How much is he going to save? Not this guy, just in general. Because, I mean, I'm looking at this going, it's 148 acres. I don't know what the zoning is. Do you know what the zoning is?
It's close to the fairgrounds.
Is it urban?
Well,
I mean, it's urban zoning, that would be huge. But I'm thinking if it's like zoned Ag 20 and it's 140 acres, so the most you can get would be seven lots, it's going to cost you at least $100,000 just to go through the process to get a short plat for seven lots. It, you know, so I mean, how much a year are you actually saving?
Well, figure it's about, and I'm guessing, but I think it's about 70%. So if your current property taxes are $10,000, your after property taxes are $3,000. So.
But how do they get that much of a reduction?
Because their valuation. It's a formula, but.
But they're already taking out one house for your house.
Correct.
So the remaining land value is basically open space plus whatever value seven lots are.
What they would do is they would,
after you subtract your
appraise unimproved rural property, they do some of what you just described, which is figure out its developability and what it sells for on the market right now on a per acre basis. Yeah. But they appraise the property, they calculate that, and then whatever it is, there's the reduction that I mentioned. Now, in terms of how the assessor appraises rural property, you're way outside of my area, okay. but I can, all I was responding to is just what the net reduction is likely to be, and it's around that rate. That
so people in the program are getting about a 70% reduction?
It's about that.
Okay, well that's pretty good.
Just offering a comment, one thing you might want to think about with these sorts of applications is trying to quantify what is the economic benefit to the community by providing that, because let's say he is saving $70,000 a year
when you 70%.
Yeah, or whatever, 70%. But when you look at that in terms of, okay, the loss of that as a habitat on soil conservation and the impact on civil engineering infrastructure and the like, when you start weighing some of those economic benefits up, it really shows the significant gains that you can have by acquiring properties through a program like this with minimal impact to the county. But I just sort of throw it out there as a suggestion to sort of provide some economics around some of this, not just the application itself.
Which I think is partly what Oliver spoke about. Yeah. That's sort of a statewide question. Mm-hmm. It's really much bigger than this one application.
But you can do it at what does that mean to this community? Because it's not like you're getting economic and community benefits from access, unless access is going to be provided to all members of the community. It's probably not going to be. So there is a loss of benefit to the community versus an equivalent amount of open space in another category. That's what I'm sort of suggesting you sort of think about balancing the whole picture when these applications come through. Just for decision making, it just makes it easy to make a decision.
But you'd have to have community agreement on what the value is to start with. And whether it's habitat, aquifer recharge, you know, high class soil, is that appreciated in an economic value?
There's enough research out there to show exactly how that all translates.
Well, that research doesn't necessarily translate into policy value, though, I guess is my concern in saying that. Because right now, I think it's still fair to say that most rural land is considered placeholder until we can figure out how to develop it. And therefore, the economic value is as developed land, not as open space, habitat, timberland. So we would have to have a community agreement about the value of the undeveloped component. before, you'd have a trade study that you could actually quantify.
Do we see a lot of these parcels getting kicked out of the program or opting out and having to give those deferred taxes back?
Oh yeah.
I don't think so. No. Yeah. I mean, there's a handful that I'm sure gets that come out every year or every couple of years.
But yeah.
I think one of the biggest ones that I've heard of is agriculture. That they stop producing the agriculture. They're not meeting that requirement.
Erickson's and right. Philida was in the program. Yeah.
So it's the religious field along Bombay Creek was in the program as well, but they came out.
One more question about taxes.
Yeah.
Say a guy goes into the program for 10 years, then he decides to develop the land to, it's all of a sudden incorporated in the growth management boundaries. He decides to turn it into a development. So he has to pay 7 years back taxes at the original assessed value.
Yeah.
In the meantime, the people that have been supporting his tax deduction, do they get a rebate?
They get his payment.
These are great questions for the assessor.
So it looks like the county gets a windfall.
Potentially, yeah. I don't, Chris, do you have any insight?
Well, the way that it's paid back is it's actually, depending on, again, remember I said that there's a two-year advance notice requirement. Let's assume there's no notice given. Today you get an offer from somebody. Your property's been in open space for 7 years, and you get an offer to take your or to buy, sell your property, and the developer's going to use it for whatever. And you jump on it, and when you go, the seller has to pay the back taxes. And what that would be is 7 years back taxes plus interest plus penalties. There's a penalty associated with taking property out without giving notice. And so there's a cost for bringing it out. And property owners are told that this is intended to be a long-term program and that you actually can have a net loss if you put it in for 5 years and you have to pay back taxes and interest and penalties. And by the way, the taxes that are forgiven are year by year based on the appraised value. So as your property appraises, your taxes may still go up. They'll only go up proportionally, and that formula is applied to every new appraisal period. So, you know, in year one, if it's worth $10,000, and assuming my math was right, or my guess about what that formula is, you would have 30% of that. In year two, if it became $11,000, it'd be 30% of that, and it keeps stair-stepping, or if it goes down in a given year. The point is that when you pay it back in the same ratio that you paid it in the first year, together with interest and penalties, if you don't give notice.
But I think what his point was is that burden that went on everyone else, it was paid. Those taxes were paid.
Right.
And now this person who takes it out is going to pay them again. So the county's getting twice.
Well,
right?
Certainly the county gets that revenue comes back, and we don't refund it to the property owners who paid during that intervening period. That absolutely is true.
That's not right.
So, Richard, you're working under the belief that if we had a good revenue year for the county, that they'd give you a rebate anyway.
I know, it's going to go to school for everything else.
Yeah,
this is an argument, we don't have a kicker.
Yeah, right. The kicker is you're not in Oregon.
I like what you're thinking.
If they sell it to the county for the park, then they don't have to pay back. They don't have to pay the taxes back.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah.
So it depends on what the use is that it goes to.
Yes. In some cases, some property owners have permitted it for a park or for something else, or for an easement or something. So it goes both ways.
Well, this has been a great discussion tonight, and I know we didn't do it the justice that Jim would have done it, so in his honor, thank you for this evening, and we'll see you guys in 2 weeks.
Thank you. All right, thanks. All
thanks.
Right.
Thank you.
Good night.
Oh, I think Lori is up next.
See, the unfortunate part is Richard just found out he's been had again. Not that anything's different, it's just now he found out about it. Yeah, let me get my mess out of my...
I'm just waiting to move on to the next one.
Yeah, oh, I have a beard, so I can do this and make it think I'm in deep thought.
Oh, is that what that?
Yeah.
Actually, I just barely trimmed it up today.
Was that beer with a D or without?
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. My name is Lori Lebowski.
We're on tape.
My name is Lori Lebowski. I'm with Community Planning, and I'm here with Oliver tonight. We're going to talk about the Open Public Meetings Act. So I'll just touch on that briefly. We're going to talk about changing some of the procedures for the Planning Commission. Just to give you a little bit of background, since we have two new Planning Commission members, we thought it would be a good idea to just investigate or look at how Planning Commission is run, the rules and procedures, and do we need to change things a little bit. Chris Cook couldn't make it tonight, but she's going to be here on April 20th for your work session to talk about the Open Meetings Act. But I do want to just, before I get into any of the subject matter, I want to talk about what's in your binder. So if you look at tab 2 of your binder, the first two documents you're going to see are, well, the first document is just the staff report, just my overview of the subject matter. And then after that, there are two documents, and they're both from MRSC, and they're talking about the Open Meetings Act. Yeah, Sonia has it up on the screen. When we did our review about how PC is run, we thought kind of three components. Number one, just education. We should have more education in PC, provide more information. So as far as Open Meetings Act, and Chris Cook will talk to you about this more on the 20th, just have more training about the Open Meetings Act. We looked at City of Camas Planning Commission and City of Vancouver Planning Commission, and they have a training every year regarding the Open Meetings Act. And actually, the Attorney General's website, they have an online training for Open Meetings Act. And if you're the Camas or the Vancouver Planning Commission, you have to go through that online training every year. And then at the end, you get to print out a certificate. And then they have to show it to the planning director there. And that's just a requirement there. And we looked at that and thought it would be a good idea to have more training on the Open Meetings Act. Also, if you look in your binders, you don't have this on the screen, but behind the blue paper, if you'll just go back there real quick. When I was doing research, I found this document. I liked it a lot. It's called Planning ABCs, and it's just really basic information about planning commissions. It goes over issues such as educating yourself, conflicts of interest, dealing with staff, ex parte contacts. My recommendation is that you all can keep this, of course, but look at it. But I think for new members, we want to include this in the binders that we give every new member, just to help have an idea about how planning commissions work, who's involved, and just to be more successful on planning commission. The next thing I want to discuss are opening statements. if you go back to the toward the beginning, it's the top of the document says PC Chair opening statement, and Sonia has it up on the screen also. So we don't have this now, but we looked at, again, City of Camas, City of Vancouver, they do have the PC Chair reads a statement at the beginning of each hearing. And so I've been working with Steve and Chris Cook on having us do an opening statement. And we've done a lot of revisions on it, and it's here in your binder. And really the idea is to, first of all, just talk about how does the hearing work. It's good for the audience. They know how to testify, how the hearing's going to be run, how the process goes. And that's what would be read. It gives people direction as far as when they testify, just some guidelines. Don't show up and repeat what the person said before you. Try to address the standards. And then finally, on page 2, talks about conflicts of interest, and the PC chair would just ask anyone at the beginning on the PC if you believe you have a conflict of interest.
And if I may add, I think the Planning Commission, for those that have been on the Planning Commission for quite some time, you're already doing this. I don't anticipate that the chair will be reading this every night, depending on the audience, but it's just something that other cities do. And if some of you, and I know that the chair sometimes appear before the hearing examiner, which is more quasi, hearing, you will see the hearing examiner read this out at every hearing. It's a way to show his independence or her independence, but for the Planning Commission, if you look at page 2, item number 4 there, we deleted that. Often, people before you who are testifying typically don't get into legal arguments, and they don't make recommendations. You know that already. We just decided to delete that as an example.
Well, also, I just want to add, as I've been saying, I believe this opening statement I got from City of Camas Planning Commission, and their Planning Commission is different because they do review quasi-judicial applications. So that was another Planning Commission here. It doesn't review. Generally, it's legislative. Sometimes we have annual reviews, and that will be more quasi-judicial. And maybe in that situation, we would have some language about testimony or ex parte contact or something like that. Are there any questions about the opening statement? Then the next document after the opening statement, these are the rules of procedure that currently govern the Planning Commission. I went and looked, and they hadn't been updated since 2007. So I worked with Chris Cook on just basically reorganizing this document. Some things need to be changed, such as if you look at the paragraph at the top on page 1, we no longer have county commissioners, we have county counselors. Special meetings, for example, it's the community planning director in consultation with the PC chair. That's when we decide to have special meetings. So you'll just see that some things that just cleaning up language. I did in here limit testimony to 3 minutes per person, but of course it's up to the discretion of the chair. If you don't have a lot of people that night, you can allow for them to provide longer testimony. So I wanted to provide this information tonight and have you all take a look at it. And if you have any comments about it or any questions, you can send emails to me, or I didn't bring my email address tonight, but you can send send it through Sonia. But when you're okay with this, when we all reach an agreement, I can come back and schedule a hearing. We need to have some type of formality to adopt these changes.
I had a question about a quorum for work sessions and how important that would necessarily be.
Yeah, I believe that we, Chris and I, yeah, we changed it to where it was for both work sessions and hearings.
Seems like we've had work sessions when we haven't had a quorum.
Yeah,
right.
There has been in the past.
Yes.
I think it's the discretion, your discretion. What you all think about whether or not you need a quorum for a work session or not. This was something Chris and I thought that we changed.
Yeah, I think in consideration of those that show up, it really depends on how early we're able to give notice of cancellation. Because once you set your course and you're planning on coming here, to show up and find out it's canceled is really a drag, too. Mm.
Yeah.
But Sonia, you send out an email. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, oh, no, I understand. It's all a matter of whether you're able to receive it. Right. Whether everybody gets the message or you don't get the message. And
we may think there's a quorum and someone may have a last minute emergency and all of a sudden there's three instead of four. And
Right.
What does the open public meeting law say about work sessions? Is that a public meeting that requires a quorum or?
Well, the question really doesn't revolve around the issue of quorums as opposed to some other kind of meeting. They look to whether you take action. And the problem with action is if you look at 4230, it's incredibly broad. It's the receipt of testimony, it's deliberation, it's discussion, it's any of about, and including the final vote. But if you actually look at the definition of action, it's so broad that the issue that you face is, I believe you probably need to have a quorum for a work session because you're discussing these matters. And because you're discussing them, that's action under 4230. You certainly could preserve testimony for the next meeting if in fact you had somebody show up, and out of courtesy for the people who come that aren't able to return. And our council does it also, but technically you have a problem even receiving testimony in that kind of a setting. Now I can take a look at it.
Well, we don't receive testimony at a work session.
No.
Okay, so the public doesn't, if the public appears, then nothing happens. They can listen, and the real question is whether or not
our discussion constitutes deliberation.
Whether you can deliberate or discuss. And just for the sake of tonight's meeting, I'll look up the definition of action because it's surprisingly broad, and it's the reason why. I guess it was Battleground School District that got in trouble because they were sending emails, school commissioners were sending emails to each other, and the court ultimately concluded that was sufficient because it went to enough of them that constituted a quorum, and they were basically discussing action they were planning on taking, and the court held that was a violation, that was at least could be, it was written in the context of it could have been a violation, but the definition of action is, let's see. Action means the transaction of any official business of a governing body, including but not limited to receipt of public testimony, deliberation, discussion, consideration, review, evaluation, and final action, and then of course, final action means the collective positive or negative decision. So that's how broad it is.
So we went through this, and I'm going to say it was 6 years ago, Well, I don't know, maybe longer.
I think it was 10 years ago, because the last time we updated our procedural order was 2007.
So at that time, the discussion around work sessions was one, if we did not take public testimony, people could come and listen, but we did not allow them to interject their opinions or questions even. They could not even give us questions. And
we typically don't.
Right, but I just think we would have to be, in some cases, forceful for that, because in the past, public members have chosen to want to interject. But the other part about it was, we could ask clarifying questions for the point of discovery, but we could not deliberate components here to say, I don't want this, or let's talk about throwing that out. There wasn't anything like that that could take place either. If we kept our own boundaries in regard to that, we could say, we need to discuss this when we have the hearing.
Yes, you could. I can tell you that Chris can interject, because part of the issues that have come up is, yes, you said that the Planning Commission works session is public, but the public showed up and cannot say anything. You know, so that's a big concern. But I'm not saying that you should now open it up for the public to be interjecting or commenting on it at your work session. That's going to be your decision, and if you keep it that way, then we may avoid this issue of action. But Chris can.
But I think it sounds like if we're going to do that, we also have to be very careful that we're not discussing at work sessions, and all we can do is ask questions.
Yes.
And tonight we've already had some discussion that probably went well beyond just asking questions. So if we want to keep the procedural order as it is and not have a quorum necessarily for a work session, I think we probably need to be more careful about not discussing at work sessions and only asking questions. Might be easier to adopt the rule that says we have to have a quorum, and then we can have the discussion if we want to at a work session.
But then are we going to be able to say that the public is legitimately able to step in and comment? And
that's discretionary with you.
Yes, that's what I mean.
I mean, you can still have it. You can have an open public meeting, and the board regularly, by the way, has work sessions where they have an open public meeting and they don't accept testimony. Because at some point, you have to get work done.
Right.
And the testimony can triple the length of a meeting. And so you have the right to, first of all, you control your own rules of procedure. We don't dictate them.
Right.
And second of all, you can choose to not accept testimony but still require a quorum. And even if you adopt a rule that requires a quorum, but for whatever reason you don't get one on a particular night, you can still take some, or you can still receive some information without taking action and not run afoul of the Open Public Meetings Act, but not have to go home empty-handed.
Okay, because yeah, I don't think we take action at any of these work sessions.
Well,
by the definition he just read, if we're discussing, that's action under that definition.
Yeah, that's the problem. The legislature intended the OPMA to be so broad so that people, governmental entities, would not try to find an end around. And I don't want to say they weren't trusting, but it appears they weren't trusting.
Although if there's only three people here, there's not a quorum. So would it not be a public meeting then, because it's not a quorum and they could discuss? Because it's not a public meeting, because they don't have any quorum.
I'm sorry, missed your point. Maybe it was intentional.
No, if they're less than a full quorum of the Planning Commission, then it's not a public meeting.
You're right, absolutely.
And so then they could discuss it because it's less than a quorum.
Absolutely, Cass.
Yeah.
If there's not a quorum, if two or three of you get together and are having lunch and you want to talk about the agenda coming up, no problem. If two of you decide to argue in the elevator because of this, obviously no problem. So, no.
If four of us get together and have lunch, we can't talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Two can, but three can't.
Three can, but four can't.
So my concern with the quorum was more procedural. If we, for some reason, didn't have a quorum, required here,
does that screw the whole docket up? Because the intention is to have a work session before we have the hearing, and if we can't have a work session, then...
Then they're going to have to reschedule the work session for some time before we have the hearing.
But Chris said we can still get information from staff.
You could, but it wouldn't be our work session. If we say here we have to have a work session for a quorum and only three show up, then you can get information from staff, but that's not going to be our formal work session because we didn't have a quorum, so we didn't have a work session. If we adopt the rule that says we need a quorum for a work session. So if we need a work session before we can go to hearing, they'd have to reschedule another work session sometime before we can have
a meeting. Have to have a meeting before
hearing. And I would say that's probably my primary concern with adopting the quorum condition.
It might delay hearings.
Yeah, I'm all in favor of the Planning Commission getting all the information that they need to be prepared for the hearing. If they miss the work session, it's my opinion, it's incumbent upon you
to find out how to get that
information to your satisfaction. But
I'll just add too really quickly that, you know, respond to Sonia's email so we know ahead of time whether or not you're going to attend.
Yeah. But things happen occasionally.
Things happen. We all think we're diligent and in response.
I thought it was call if you don't. That's if you're not coming, let you know.
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking at.
But I think what Ron's saying is even if we all do that and we all say we're not going to come next week to the work session, and so now you know a week in advance there's no work session, that solves the problem of people coming for no reason, but it still might delay the hearing, because if you have a work session scheduled for, you know, the 6th of the month and the hearing is on the 16th and now the work session gets canceled, they may need to cancel the hearing too and push the whole thing off another month, so our business may get delayed.
Right.
So if I'm understanding correctly right now, three of us show up, we can still have the work session.
Yes. Under our current rules.
We can still have it, everything moves forward.
I'm not sure if you really legally can under the open public meetings law. If only three show up, it's not a quorum.
Well, the question is a quorum. The question for you, and I haven't looked, I'm your stand-in, so I haven't really reviewed the rules of procedure in detail. Do your rules require that a work session occur before you have a public hearing?
I don't believe so.
Well, I don't think so, but that has been our practice for the last 2 years. We've never had a hearing.
But that begs the question, doesn't it? I mean, isn't the real issue if it once required, if it's not required? Let's assume you have a simple issue that is just a question of whether or not you're going to recommend approval of a regulation that the legislature requires us to have, but because it's a development regulation, we don't really have a choice. And you choose not to have a work session on it because, you know, what are you going to really do in that case? Is that going to be a legally recommended action? And if it's not required, my answer would be yes. If it is required, then it changes the answer. But that's why I was looking to see.
I don't know if there's any legal requirement for us to have a work session. It's not in our procedural rules, I don't believe.
Right.
But we've always had work sessions for... I have never seen us go to hearing without having a work session on an item in 10 years, but I don't know if that means it's required.
I would say it's been our status quo for so long, I can't remember us not doing it.
I'm not the one proposing you change, break with process, because policy and process can be your friend, but I'm just pointing something out.
But it comes back to the same scenario. Even if we're not procedurally required to have it, if we schedule one and we don't get a quorum, I believe we should adopt some rules amongst ourselves that allows us to go forward without jeopardizing that for the minority that show up. That would be my preference. If the group feels the same way, I think we could draft something appropriate in that regard that keeps us out of the hot water of taking action.
Well, if we only have three people, then we're not taking action, because it's not a public forum.
It's not a public forum.
Right. It's not a public meeting.
All right. Well, then we get back to that aspect of the difference between deliberation and...
Right, but if there's less than four people, you can deliberate, discuss as much as you want.
Okay.
It's,
so
it's
not
a quorum to take action.
All right. So are we at the place that we're covered for non-quorum events, but now we're saying such as our discussion was around the tax deferral properties that we were already over our legitimate boundaries as a quorum?
Could have done that with a non-quorum
because it wouldn't be a public meeting.
You're talking about.
Yeah, but
and
I
we could
guess
do it with a quorum because it is a public meeting, but we noticed it.
Yeah.
Right.
And the public is authorized to come and listen.
Right.
So we can deliberate
we
as
make
a quorum.
A
so what we're saying is we can deliberate as
you
a
can
quorum.
Deliberate as a quorum if it's been properly noticed.
And if it's not a quorum, no big deal because there's not enough of us to take action.
Exactly.
Right.
So we're all chill.
So if we leave the rule as it is and do not require a quorum for the work session, then we can have the work session with three people and move straight to the hearing, and it's incumbent on the other people that are going to come to the hearing that didn't go to the work session to get the staff report, read it, ask questions.
Right. Mm-hmm. And if we're not in a quorum, then I can be as irate about anything and pound my fist on the table.
It's still going to be recorded.
Yeah, but who listens to that?
let us know what you would like to see happen on page 3, because that quorum starts with a simple majority of the appointed members shall constitute a quorum for the transaction of business. And we added the word both work session and hearing. So if you characterize transaction of business to be limited to hearing, you're still going to have work session, but you may not require a quorum for that. So let us know how you want us to rework that or what your preference is, and we will certainly consider that and bring it back.
Okay, yeah, I'm thinking we probably don't want to add those other words, but we may want to wait till Chris Cook gets back and ask her why she wanted to include that, if she had a reason that we haven't talked about today. But
Okay.
All right.
We'll
flag
that. Yeah. Three of us can go meet for lunch.
It would be nice not to have that limiting.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just want to add real quick, since we're talking about quorums, that also applies to email. So if you have a distribution list, you might want to not use it as planning commission members.
Yeah.
I know it's a pain, but that's a quorum when you all email.
Does that include responding to all to sign?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, we're not, hey guys, I'm not coming?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
who knows what you're gonna say.
I
it's not mine.
if he says I'm not coming, I don't think that's
if you respond,
conversation.
Respond,
Chris may jump in, but
attached,
you know, sometimes what we try to do is when we send stuff to you or we try to send it in, we do that with our council, send it individually to them. We don't try to use reply all, but
I agree with all. I think scheduling is fine if it's we're not coming. But you don't want to reply to all and say, yeah, I really want to follow up on that point we talked about and start launching into some discussion of some issue.
And that's where it has happened, by the way.
Yeah.
We've had it happen for council where email from Counselor A to either the county manager or somebody else, but he CCs everybody so they'll know what he or she said. Then the reply is, well, I disagree.
Oh,
I think
right,
we need to do this. And you've already crossed the line.
Yeah.
So you just have to be aware on the simple things like, I agree. I can't imagine any court in the world saying, you're giving notice to everybody as a matter of courtesy that you got kids sick and that you're not going to be able to make it, that somehow that constitutes a transaction of business. That just is not going to be your problem.
No.
On the flip side, when you hit reply all, it's always a little dangerous if you're talking about the substance of anything that's on your agenda, because you know that if everybody's on the mailing list, it's going to everybody. So you just, those are the ones you just have to be careful about.
That's why I brought it up, because I know we've had issues in the past.
And keep in mind, any email you send is going to be a public record.
Yes.
Yeah, forever.
Forever, and so be careful what you write.
Yeah, yes. In fact, this is my on your behalf comment. Nothing, and I say this to every county employee, nothing important should ever be in an email.
Mm-hmm.
I just, your deliberations, your whatever, it shouldn't be in an email, because you got to remember that the public can get these for a long time. Some of the stuff we keep for 6 years, some of it goes for 11, and especially anything that is, when you're in a heat of passion and for a particular reason, you don't want to see it on the newspaper in the newspaper. So it's worthy of mentioning it, and so I'm glad that Lori brought it up.
Now, I do want to ask, when I was on the council in Richfield, we had a discussion about this, and basically, if you receive, tell me if I'm wrong, I think the discussion was if you receive emails, you know, public emails on your personal PC, that makes your personal PC
yes.
can be subpoenaed.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, there's a Court of Appeals decision that ruled that a mayor or a chair or a council person's PC was searchable because she couldn't find the email, and so they brought in a forensic examiner to look at her PC to find it. And so that's the lengths to which it goes. That's one of those tough calls for you as commissioners, because you sometimes send emails, and if you have a mixture of very sensitive things with very common everyday things, you may not want to use your PC for any official business from home. It's just a tough one. You just have to decide how to do it. And by the way, that's not any different whether or not you send text messages with your phone, because if you're sending text messages to Lori, then you may have run into the same thing. That text message, if it relates to your work as a PC commissioner, is absolutely a public record. Whether we'll ever find it, whether or not it will exist, and whether or not even more significantly anybody's going to think to ask for it is a completely different issue. But on a purely legal level, it absolutely is a public record. And that's why you'll find that a lot of county employees have started, their departments have bought phone, county phones, because we don't want to get into that position with people using their personal phones. And it just is an issue until the legislature cleans up 4256.
So just to wrap up, I'll talk to Chris Cook about that, the language on page 3 about quorums for work sessions. And feel free to email me with any questions you have about the documents. And Chris Cook's going to be back on the 20th to talk about OPMA.
So I do have a question, and the idea of how did we come up with on page 1 the idea that proponents and opponents get 20 minutes of testimony?
I took that out.
No, it's double underlined. It's not struck.
Oh.
Yeah, testimony has 20 minutes.
I think the 20 minutes was arbitrary, and so we were, you know, the proponent may be somebody representing an applicant in a case of an annual review. That was something we thought, give them 20 minutes to make their case, and then if there's someone who's primarily opposed, to give them the equal amount of time.
So that's
fairly arbitrary.
Yeah, that's 40 minutes that we were sitting and listening to two people.
Okay.
Yeah, that wasn't really added, it was just reworded, because if you look on page 2, it was scratched out, and then it was added back on page 1 in slightly different language.
That was because Chris was saying, how do you define a group? And
yeah.
So we arrived.
So you limited it to site-specific requests and proponents, and you know, I'm not sure that you, how do you, I mean, you can define the proponent pretty easy for a site-specific request, but how do you define the principal opponent?
Right.
It could be everyone that borders a piece of property has the same legitimate right to be an opponent.
But we do have it in here that we ask that they not repeat themselves. Right?
We ask that. Sometimes repeatedly.
It's in the rules of procedure and the opening statement.
Of course. I guess my concern is sometimes 5 minutes of information can be packed into 20. I'm more inclined to put a much tighter time on that and then not enforce it. Okay. If we're going to put something in writing, and I don't know how the rest of my commissioners feel about it. Well, rather than say right off the bat they get 20 minutes, I'd rather say they get 10, and if things are flowing and important and they go over and there's no bell to ring, so they go over.
Why can't we do something where everyone has, say, 3 minutes and it's up to the chair to decide whether he wants to grant an extension or not?
We do have generally in the rules of procedure 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And we mentioned it in the opening statement. We could change it for the site-specific requests. We could go back and revise that language and take out the 20 minutes.
Yeah, because why not?
Yeah, you could just take that out entirely and just leave the next page where it says you're going to get 3 minutes and the chair may also grant additional time if evidence and testimony is not repetitious.
Yeah. Okay. Just take that out.
So you could just take the first part out about the
site-specific
and then...
Okay. So just delete...
Yeah.
The site specific.
Number one.
Number one, A,
number
yeah,
one.
Or A1,
yeah. Okay.
It's up to the chair.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Is he in a good mood?
Are you being nice? Okay, perfect. Yeah. I'll just take that out.
So I noticed on page one you took out the part about if it's after 10, we need to have a vote if we're going to continue the meeting. I don't really mind, because I don't mind late nights, but I know in the past we've had some people that were using that rule to call a vote about whether we go on after 10, so we should probably discuss before we take that out of our rules. Okay. Any thoughts?
Well,
I'm for leaving it in.
You want to leave it again? Yeah, I think you were the one who called the vote. I think you got voted down. I don't think we've ever decided to stop a meeting and go home because it was late, but we did. I remember we did consider doing it, and we had a vote on it.
Right.
So,
and I think
it turned out we were almost done, and we I think we got done pretty quick.
Yeah, the testimony got a lot briefer after that.
After that vote, so there may be some purpose in having it, even if we don't.
So, how many times has that occurred where?
Where we've gone past 10, or where we've had a vote on it? I think we've only had a vote on it once. We've gone past 10 since I've been here. I don't know, a dozen times.
So C is saying planning commission shall take no additional agenda items without proper public notice.
It doesn't say continuing what you're talking about.
Right, but the way it used to say is after 10 in the evening, unless the majority of the planning commission is present, votes on extending the meeting. So we could get to 10 o'clock,
okay,
and we wrap up with that agenda item. There's more stuff on our meeting unless the majority of us decides to plow ahead. That's going to be the end of the meeting, and those other agenda items are going to have to come back next month under our current rule set.
Yeah.
The way this reads, we have to just keep on plowing ahead until we're done because we don't have the ability to stop the meeting.
Well, I think you always have the ability to move to adjourn. You can say, if the majority of you conclude that, let's assume it's a particularly tense and challenging item, and you've had them, obviously, and you get done and you just go, I can't think straight. And you say, we can go forward, but you're not going to get me concentrate any legitimate discussion on me, and I need to leave. And four of you agree with that. I can't imagine in the world that you would keep going, even if you only had another half an hour to go. Now, that's up to you, but leaving this in doesn't hurt either, because that just formalizes that.
Yeah, I think that's why we put it in there, because we wanted to have a formal... You know, yeah, and also it gives us a rule, so if we really want to call it a quits for the night, we have a little bit of cover. It's not like we're going outside of our, you know, it's like our rule says, unless the majority agree to move forward, we're not moving forward.
And it gives the public some upfront notice.
Yeah.
That, you know, if they're four agenda items away and it's 9 o'clock, you know, they're going to
want to wait till 10 and see how our vote goes.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, is if
so
there are four or five.
Like to leave it in?
If there
sounds
are four
like,
or five,
yeah. We have at least a couple people that feel pretty strongly about leaving it in. I'm okay either way, but I'm definitely okay leaving it in.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's design review.
Okay. We'll leave it in.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks for your comments, and feel free to email. email me if you have any more comments or questions.
But don't copy everyone.
Yeah, don't copy.
Yeah, that's all we have.
Yes.
First page that says, I will, in consultation with the chair, call a special meeting. We haven't been really doing that, but this will be as need warrants, because we now have a good example would be the appeal and our response to the appeal. If the council decides to makes a decision on how to proceed, because it's a growth management hearings order, I may call a special meeting to have the planning commission consider whatever the council asks us to do. So
when are they going to decide?
The ruling came out on Thursday. We had a work session with them the following Wednesday, so they're still mulling over the ruling. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they will let us know, because as soon as possible, because we have April 24th to file
appeal if we want to appeal.
Yes.
Can I get a parking server?
Yes.
All right, Gary, you're going to talk to us about houseboats,
yes,
floating homes.
Possible. Thank you. So, Gary Albrecht, Clark County Community Planning. So, I wanted to talk about the Shoreline Master Program. So, we're doing a limited amendment to our Shoreline Master Program. So, I put together some slides for Robin and Matt. I'm not sure how much you know about the County Shoreline Master Program. So, I could go over those. I'll try to go rather quickly, or I can just skip that and go to what the proposal is about.
I'd like to go through it.
Okay.
Just you can just run through it real quick.
Sure. Here.
More information is good.
So there you go. Thank you. So the Shoreline Management Act was created in 1971. It was passed by the legislature by a group of citizens to initiate shoreline resources, protection of shoreline resources. And then the intent of the act is to prevent the inherent harm in an uncoordinated and piecemeal development of the state shorelines. So the SMA provides an overarching framework of goals and policies. So in this slide here, the goals and policies are, there's three of them: foster reasonable and appropriate uses, or water-dependent uses is what we like to call them. And then the second one is protect natural resources, or environmental protection. And then the third one is promote public access. It's a public access for visual and physical access. Next slide. So what is the Shoreline Master Program? It's a planning document, a set of regulations, administrative framework for us. It's a long-range plan that defines goals and policies for shoreline development, and it's consistent with the Comprehensive Growth Management Plan. So the next slide. So where does the Shoreline Management Act apply? So river shorelines, so you see the blue in the middle, the water, and the ordinary high water mark is regulated from the sides. So it's out 200 feet from there. So that's our shoreline jurisdiction, and then we've included associated wetlands. So it could go from the ordinary high water mark to 200 feet, and if the associated wetlands go out 400 feet, then it would pull the jurisdiction out to 600 feet. So there are about 283 miles of shorelines in Clark County. And the next slide. So that's how our shoreline looks. So we've got six shoreline designations. It's aquatic, natural, urban conservancy, medium intensity, high intensity, rural conservancy, residential, and rural conservancy resource land. So as far as what's what, so when it comes to shorelines of statewide significance, there's some criteria that applies for that. It's a mean annual flow of 1,000 cubic feet per second or greater. So rivers like the Columbia River and the Lewis River, and then lakes greater than 1,000 acres in size, like Merwin and Yale and Vancouver Lake. Those are bodies of statewide significance. And then shorelines of the state, it's a mean annual flow of 20 cubic feet per second. So like Washougal River, Fifth Plain Creek, Burbridge Creek. Moving on. So the GMA and the SMA, they are coordinated together. So the Shoreline Management Act is the 14th goal of the Growth Management Act. And the SMP regulates the critical areas in shoreline jurisdictions. So the shoreline regulations must protect at least as well as the critical areas regulations. Moving on. So proposed changes. There should have been a slide back there. No net loss.
Yeah, she showed it.
You did?
It was like seven.
Passed quietly.
I think so.
There we go. So, you know, as far as when we're implementing the plan and issuing out permits, our goal is for the plan to have no net loss of ecological functions. So when it comes to a specific reach, we want to make sure that reach on the North Fork of the Lewis isn't going below the initial baseline that we established in 2012. So as far as function goes, we don't want the function of that reach to go any lower than what it's already described as. So that's the goal of our plan, is no net loss. So we're in the process of monitoring that right now, and we'll bring together some information for you guys later on this year to show you how the progress of our shoreline program. So that's, thank you for going back. And then as far as the proposed changes go, so we've got three basic changes. So we're going to revise the composition of the Shoreline Management Committee. So our Environmental Services Department is part of the Shoreline Management Review Committee. And so if a conditional use permit comes through or exemption, they need to go through the Shoreline Management Review Committee, and we're just revising that because we don't have an Environmental Services Department anymore. So that's kind of a cleanup for us. And then the other two we're adding are based on changes in the legislation. So the second one is to create a substantial development permit exemption for retrofitting existing structures to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And then the third one there's actually two parts to the third one. It's a new state requirement for dock construction. So it basically changes the requirement from $10,000 to $20,000 when it comes to rebuilding your dock. So anytime the structure goes from 10,000, so if threshold was 10,000, they just moved it up to 20,000. So I've got some specific language in the staff report if you want to get into that. And then the second part of number three is we're adding a floating on water residence definition to our definitions. That's the legislative decided that it was based out of a case out of Seattle. They were having some problems of what a floating home was or a floating on water residence, so they made a definition for us to include in our master program. So that is all I have.
So
Gordy wanted me to ask you why we need two definitions, one for floating home and one for floating on water residence.
I appreciate you asking that. I love Gordy. You know, that's a really good question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I know why. So as far as a floating home goes, the way our current definition is that the floating home is it's built on a float. So it's got a log. The house is built on the log, or it's a float. And so it's before, I think, 2012. And then the floating residence is built on or before after 2014. So in a floating on-water residence is, it includes everything other than what was built on a float. So it's
very difficult.
Because it's extremely confusing.
It is confusing because one of the things we're debating, not debating, but considering is that water dependent? How do we say that a home is water dependent? You know, or are they getting to this definition to really say that we want to grandfather recognize existing stuff that already on the dock, if you will? Because I look at a floating home or a home, that's not water dependent.
I found some good graphics for a floating on water residence. Can you pull up the picture? So I sent this to Ecology and asked them for their input if it would help define what a floating on water residence is. That would be a floating on water residence. It's a motor home.
Oh, you know what? I went to Vietnam a couple years ago. I got some pictures I should
add to your collection.
That's one non-water residence.
Yeah, so many things that is happening.
So, isn't a boat then a floating on-water residence?
Well, so looking at our definitions. So if you go back, and so I think it's tab 4.
Yeah. Tab 4.
So page 32 of the 40. We say a floating home. Floating home means a single family dwelling unit constructed on a float that is moored, anchored, or otherwise secured in waters and is not a boat, even though it may be capable of being towed. And then the new state's definition is floating on water residence means any floating structure other than a floating home as defined above that is designed or used primarily as a residence on the water and has detachable utilities and whose owner or primary occupant has held an ownership interest in space in a marina or has held a lease or sublease to use space in a marina since a date prior to July 1st, 2014.
Yeah, so this is getting to existing stuff.
So that would be a boat.
So that's a boat.
That would be a boat.
Yeah.
What do you mean by a detachable utilities?
They have cord connects. Yes. They have couplings that you can you can disconnect and
just like a motorhome.
Whereas the other category are thought to be more permanent.
Yes. Yeah. You have to actually
hard plumbed
wire it in.
Well,
or something more than you're talking about, like a motorhome kind of connection,
well,
or a boat connection where you just screw it down.
Have you ever seen the air hoses on a semi truck? On the back of a semi truck, they have these little connections that you just line up and you twist them, and that makes the connection. A lot of the houseboats have something similar, or RVs that are allowed in the flood zones have to have quick connects so that in the event of high water events they can move, but it's something like that.
Okay, so RV type connections is what they're talking about here with detachable.
Right.
Something you can just do without tools.
Mm-hmm. Oh, with tools, yeah.
And I don't believe any of our marinas have a floating on water residence.
Somebody living on a sailboat, if you had one, that they were living there before 2014, that would be a floating on water.
I don't believe they have them up there. So that McCuddy's Marina, they've got floating homes.
Okay.
Cadaw's Marina, they've got floating homes also.
Okay. Yeah, I looked at that definition and I was probably able to get myself.
Well, it's one of those things that, I mean, it's the legislator requires us to have it. Whether they want us to have two definitions, that's up to us to figure out. Do we need a floating home or a floating on water residence? What's the difference?
I'm not sure, based on that new definition, that if we had a sailboat that somebody was living on and it was in a marina, that it wouldn't completely qualify, though. It seems like it would.
Oh, I think
qualify.
It would. If it, yeah. if it had been there since July 1, 2014, and somebody had been living in it the whole time, I think it would totally qualify as a floating on-water residence.
It's trying to get to someone to take that down and pitch us up.
Mm-hmm. So we have the definition. What does staff report say that you are expecting from us in regard to these two definitions then?
I'm not sure it's just the definition. It's that later on in the regulations, if they're put in or they exist within a certain time frame, if you look at 23 of 40, under paragraph 12 and 13, it's that they're considered conforming uses. And so they're essentially, I assume they're granting them a legal status if they existed within a particular time frame.
Right, right.
And so that's why this may be more of a Seattle issue, is you've got these structures up there, people have lived on, and the question is, do they have to meet new rules or old? And there probably was a sufficient push. Now, I'm speculating to some extent, but I'm not sure I'm too far out there.
You also get a one-time expansion.
Yep, you do. As long as
you can make your boat bigger,
the footprint, and you don't go above a maximum height.
Yeah, put a deck on it. But all right, so a person has a sailboat and they want to park it in a marina.
And live on it.
Yeah.
Then they have to have been doing it since before July 1, 2014.
But are we saying that they can't?
Well,
after July 2014?
Not on a permanent basis, or at least without complying with the Shoreline Management Act.
But the marina is already in place and the slip is available. I'm just trying to understand. Is it the marina or is it the residence then? Because the marina is there.
The issue is they don't want you living on it for more than 30 days or whatever the day is, whatever the limitation is versus for residency versus, you know, it's recreational.
I think it's difficult, Ron, to answer your question because the thing you don't know is how the marina was permitted in the first place. And so if it's permitted as some kind of a permanent for permanent residential purposes as opposed to transitional or seasonal use, that use would have been reviewed differently. I can't guess what it is, but imagine a different scenario. Imagine you've got a dock in front of your house and you're living off the Columbia. And the question becomes whether or not you get to have your kids living in a sailboat at the edge of your dock because it's existed since 2011.
So like parking an RV in my driveway.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the county will come after you for that if you live in it.
I think he's saying the scenario is the same thing. But I do think there's a certain validity to the clarification about this July 2014 date is more appropriate for the marina and what its established use is, as opposed to saying whether an individual boat can do that then.
Why don't we try and contact Ecology and get more clarification about whether or not we'll ask specifically, is a sailboat intended to be included, and what would happen if? And we'll use your exact example.
I'd appreciate that, because I'm wondering whether we're inhibiting the marina owner's ability to do business in some fashion, and I don't know whether that's even legitimate or not, but I'd like to explore the idea that we're not doing something that is changing the nature of the clientele that the person can receive.
I think that's exactly what Ecology is trying to do. With the exemption, if it's been there since 2014, you can keep doing it.
Okay, but I guess I would rather be in a position of saying to somebody, the Planning Commission didn't make this decision that's kicking you off of the marina. Ecology
did. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily have to agree with it. I can't do anything about it. So that's I guess I would like that clarification.
Ron, easy enough to do.
Well, us.
Well, I looked at Cadao's website. So they have Cadao's meter. That's out here off Little River Road.
Uh-huh.
So they have 18-footer homes, but then there's a place where you can have a boat out there too. And they specifically say you're not allowed to spend the night out there or sleep out there. So they have their own rules in place already. So, and it gets confusing on, okay, so what are you trying to regulate? The slips or people living there? Because they have the homes there.
Okay, and so that business has already made a business decision about that. And I get, we could survey every available marina spot and understand it clearer. Or we could just say, for the purposes of understanding this even going forward, what is the intention of the rule?
It's just too easy to ask. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll find out psychology.
Okay. I suspect they're trying to keep people from living on the water, because I was involved in Oregon, very similar issues. Multnomah County decided they didn't want any more houseboats, and they wanted to get rid of the ones they had. They couldn't get rid of all of them that have been there literally 100 years, but they, just about a year or two, 2 years ago, they really tightened their rules on Multnomah Channel, off Sovies Island, and all those right. existing marinas, and basically said, You've got the houseboats. You can't have any more. If you pull those ones out, you can't put them back. I mean, right. They just basically said houseboats are now non-conforming use because we've decided that they're not water dependent under Oregon's version of the SMA. So no new houseboats, and that's I'm sure that's what ecology is doing in Seattle.
When they disconnect them and they push them up to Ridgefield and Parker.
Yeah.
I just want to know whether...
Well, over in Multnomah County, they can put them on the Columbia River because their rules regarding water-related and water-dependent uses only apply on the Willamette River. They do not apply on the Columbia. So that's what they're doing. They're saying, hey, you got to go find a marina on the Columbia. You got to get all these off the Willamette and off Multnomah Channel.
I appreciate that.
Sure.
If you'll ask.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any other questions that I can ask or answer?
Any buildings that are on, or homes that are on pilings?
And they're not floating. That's what you're saying. They're in the water.
This wouldn't apply because they're not floating.
Right.
They're on the shoreline.
You've got a whole different set of rules that would apply to that.
Yeah, they would have the rules that's in shoreline management, but not the floating home rules.
Floating home.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have floodplain rules to make sure you're above the 100-year flood, but I'm not sure what other rules you'd have.
Make sure your house is still above it after the water's risen.
You have your critical area setbacks.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we'll see you in a couple weeks. Some answers.
What, we're done with that already?
Yeah.
That was too short.
Not at all. We welcome houseboats within the guidelines that are laid out right there.
Floating on water.
But you couldn't do it.
All right, is that it?
Yes.
All right, we're adjourned.
Deliberation's over,
Thank
Carl.
You, everyone.
We don't even have a quorum anymore.